everybody. Welcome to the XL podcast number 27. I first of all have to plug the live podcast that we're doing at the Cartoon Museum.
Yeah.
When is it?
26th of August. Go to the Cartoon Museum website. Use whatever search engine you use. Search for Cartoon Museum London.
As part of our tour of only doing
museums,
places that are called museum. There's a museum comedy, cartoon museum. We'll only play museums. I remember a promoter once saying to me he was going to do a tour of corn exchanges because there are a surprising number of corn exchanges places.
Yes, there are.
Cambridge, there's one.
There's one in the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, you could just play. You could call it the corn exchange tour and you could just, corn is, at a premium at the moment.
And we could have the band Corn supporting us.
Anywho, the podcast this week is an interview I read. There's a former Labour staffer called Phil Bevan who wrote an really interesting article. It was sort of about the Ford report. Ask your dad if you don't know what that is. No, don't ask your dad. look on some left-wing website. But it was ostensibly about the Ford report, but it was about working in the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. I thought it was fascinating. And so this is my interview with Phil Bevan.
Let's go.
Let's go. Okay, so when lockdown started, and also I suppose it's because it was the end of the Corbyn experiment, I suppose, I previously, as I've probably said before, had nothing but disdain for the Labour Party and knew nothing about its internal workings. But for some reason, with the end of Corbyn's reign as leader of the Labour Party, I became obsessed with the internal shenanigans of the Labour Party. And during the early months of lockdown, I read like 6 or 8 books about, I read all of Tony Benn's diaries. And previously having indifference to internal shenanigans in the Labour Party, I became fascinated. And I suppose we can expand on why that is. Where was it you wrote a short piece?
It was the Squawk Box news site.
Squawk Box, which is a website I look at several times a day. and I've been on...
Me too.
I've been on the TV channel, and it's basically just saying derogatory things about Keir Starmer, isn't it? Really,
that's kind of my bag as well.
typical headline will be, Starmer revealed as a shitbag. But it is all about internal monkey business, mostly committed by the left. Committed by the right in the Labour Party now and in the past 5 years. So I was particularly taken with your article because it was a kind of deep dive in some ways, a look internally into Labour Party shenanigans. And I don't know whether this will be our worst selling podcast of all time, or maybe it'll be our most, I think maybe my listenership who initially, got a lot of Corbyn and political stuff. And then we kind of pivoted towards comedians and rappers and stuff, but now we're back. You could not get more internal Labour Party nonsense than this edition. So Phil, introduce yourself and tell us what you wrote.
Slightly concerned that it's going to be a bit niche, but I'm Phil Bevan. I worked for Jeremy Corbyn in what I must admit was a very minor role in his leadership office in the Labour Party. With Jeremy being quite a down-to-earth guy, I actually worked quite closely with him personally, even though the job I was doing was mainly kind of administrative. So I did see some of the shenanigans going on close at hand. I also spent a very brief period, about a month or so, doing some admin in Labour's compliance unit, the complaints team. So I saw what was coming in through the inbox and I got a sense of what the complaints actually were, who was sending them and that kind of thing. And before that, I've done a range of things. I mean, I got a job in Corbyn's office semi by accident. I didn't expect to actually get the job. I applied for it. I'd had a bad day of work, so I just fired off an application for the job because it was due to. It was. I only saw it that night, and it was due to close that day. So yeah, I fired it off in the expectation I wouldn't get it, or even hear back or anything. And then eventually I got it, and that was that. And so it was kind of life changing in a way. But I'm not really, although I've been a member of the Labour Party since I was a member of the Labour Party between 2013 and 2020. And but I'm not really part of any particular sort of faction, as it were, because connections to the left I've never been one of those kind of left-wing Labour people. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, before that,
I'm just trying to jazz this up now, what you saw chilled you to the bone.
yes, Corbyn's horrible.
No, he's not. No, we can't say that. No, that's not, literally,
I let it that out.
Literally, we're going to have to, we're going to edit that out. Yeah.
No, he's not, he's lovely, he's really lovely. Sorry.
Friend of the show.
Yeah.
And actually, last year you wrote an article for The Canary about why it's time to leave the Labour Party.
I did, yes. So, I mean, I write all this stuff because my background actually originally is academic. So I like writing things. And I like...
You love an academic, yeah.
Yeah, I like doing deep, like Alexia was saying, kind of really kind of deep dives into stuff, which is why my articles tend to be on the long side. But no, I mean, joking aside, and that was a joke... I have a huge amount of personal respect for Jeremy, and every time I do an interview or anything like that, I always try to give him a bit of a boost because I think he gets too much criticism from sort of both sides of the debate.
Yeah.
And I think I think actually a lot of it is unfair because the Labour Party leadership under Corbyn was collective. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't him making all the decisions and everything, you know, doing everything exactly as he wanted it to. It was...
Well, that's one of the things, isn't it? People say, why didn't Jeremy disband the whole party and fill it full of cats?
That would have been fun.
And it's like, you don't, you know, there's rules. I mean, and Jeremy is, one of the ways he contrasts with various shitbags on the right is he plays by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, but he does.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, he does play by the rules. He's scrupulous.
So, yeah.
I don't even say it's foolish, because one of the kind of the misnomers that people think that, and again, this is kind of internal Labour Party workings, but the Labour's governing body, the National Executive Committee, people seem to think that the leader just controls that, which isn't necessarily the case, particularly if you're Jeremy Corbyn. Because even when he had left representation on that body, his politics within the so-called Labour left are actually very specific and very internationalist compared to other people's. So even when the left was in charge on the Labour NEC, my interpretation anyway of the situation is that Jeremy didn't have a majority for his personal politics. And that is the root of the problem, and then you get into different kind of ideological positions within the Labour left, and that all that, it gets a bit sort of...
Yeah, well, that was, I think, one of the things that sort of interested me about your article, and then when we talked on the phone, whenever it was last week or the week before, is to try and draw some lessons for this, because otherwise it's just gossip, you know, it's just it's just Bridgerton with ugly, terrible people. is to kind of
that'd be a good show
on the rise. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be really depressing, but it would also be quite funny.
Okay, yeah, Bridgerton, but set in a CLP in the Midlands. The passing of motions, the writing of letters to the local party.
It's actually how the Labour right talk.
Procedure.
It's is a that very, very accurate representation.
the extraordinary abuse of procedure by Blairite. Dinosaurs.
Yes.
It'll make really exciting television. But so, I mean, what, you know, in ultimately what we need to try and do from this is also learn lessons. But yes, one of the things that talking to you is that, yeah, you think of the left as being homogenous, or the left, the Labour Party, but in fact, there were various competing factions. And I suppose the primary, I mean, there were other things, but the primary divider in some ways was how seriously they treated the false accusation that the Labour Party on Jeremy Corbyn was a hotbed of anti-Semitism. And people had ideological, you know, I think people had ideological reasons for believing that, didn't they, really?
Mm. Well, that's my, I mean, people don't come out and say, yes, I've got an ideological reason for believing it. But no. If you look at some of the stuff that's been written by various people, like, for example, my former colleague, James Schneider, Owen Jones, and a whole range of other people, there is a consistent line that it's kind of the thesis, which is, I really hate this term, but I keep repeating it. It's called this walking and chewing gum,
right,
which is remaining vigilant against real examples of anti-Semitism whilst also calling out sort of smears against the left.
Yeah, because I never quite understood why, I mean, everybody on the Labour Party, like, they treated the accusations made by the Board of Deputies or the Jewish Chronicle as if those people were good faith actors, and they treated them seriously rather than as anti-Corbyn, you know, anti-left smears, which they were, really.
Well, there's a large section of the left, and again, it's quite hard to identify specific individuals because they don't identify themselves very clearly, that is actually very pro-Israel, at least from my point of view, as somebody who's a critic of Israel, considers it to be an apartheid state.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, the organization that is probably the most obvious one, although it's probably more fragmented than that in terms of, you know, people who share this kind of pro-Israel position, is the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. And there's quite a lot of significant, or at least a few significant members of the Socialist Campaign Group who are, well, they appear on their website, so I assume that they are in some way aligned in their position. And the AWL does have an ideological position which is relatively pro foreign intervention, pro Israel, and all the kind of stuff that Jeremy Corbyn absolutely stands against.
Yes.
And so you've got on their website, you've got people appearing like John McDonnell, for instance, who made numerous kind of, I thought, quite shocking interventions where I thought basically he threw Jeremy under a bus. And I mean, I don't know if you know, Owen Jones, I believe, used to work for John, is so I've heard. And so then you see the connection. They basically share the same point of view on this issue.
Yeah. I mean, of course, me and Owen Jones had a fairly frosty encounter on his bloody Talal made me do on his on his podcast. He said, this will make you more popular.
Talal said it went really well from his perspective.
Hey, it brought us a lot of attention. I was trying to promote the podcast, and I thought, what's the platform we can get Alexi on? Cause a bit of, I didn't know it would be so full of friction, but people enjoyed watching him squirm. I thought it was fucking bloody entertaining, painful at times, but it was an experience for sure.
And
I was still a bit green doing that. I was like, just trying to get Alexi out there on as many platforms as I could.
I mean, it's famous now. It's or infamous or whatever. But obviously it's not you, Alexi, that came off badly, so you don't need to worry.
No.
But
it was, I mean, because people like McDonald and that, I mean, you can never, if you, I mean, Labour was always fighting that battle on their enemies' territory, weren't they? They were, by accepting their framing and just endlessly apologising.
I think a lot of them actually did accept the framing. They believed the framing.
Right.
And I've only really kind of, because I always think, why are people making this mistake over and over again? Why are you still got people like James Schneider writing for Novara Media that, you know, that you still need to be really vigilant about anti-Semitism when we know, yes, it exists, but it wasn't a particularly virulent problem within the Labour Party compared to other political parties.
No, was it 0.03% of the Labour Party had actually been 0.03% of the Labour Party had actually been accused? That's not found guilty. That's what? I failed O-level maths, but is that 0.3 of a percent?
I didn't quite fail O-level maths, but I don't know how I passed my GCSE, so I can't. But it's not a tiny percentage.
And also, it wasn't like a sudden spike when Corbyn became leader.
No, I mean, that's the people accused of anti-Semitism, which is not a widespread problem by any means. Yes, but go on. Sorry.
I mean, yes, the problem with this kind of, this walking whilst chewing gum hypothesis is that when you've got this definition of anti-Semitism, which is the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition, which is really badly flawed.
Yeah, well, even actually, the guy who devised it, Kenneth Stern, says it's shit.
Yeah, it doesn't actually, it didn't define anti-Semitism, which is one of the big problems with it as a definition. Yeah. But it does, through its examples, it does link, specifically it links anti-Semitism, or says that anti-Semitism can take the form of criticism of Israel. And this is kind of the problem with the walking whilst chewing gum thing, because if you're constantly vigilant over examples of anti-Semitism and you're working to this definition, which says criticism of Israel can be anti-Semitic, then you're going to start targeting critics people who are critics of Israel. It's just going to happen, especially if you believe, if that you are actually really in your political ideology a supporter of Israel. And I think that is what a lot of people on the Labour left don't like to talk about, is that fundamentally they are supporters of Israel, because fundamentally, again, this is, if you look back at Labour history, by and large, the Labour Party, although it will sort of implement some, well, in the past, it would have implemented some relatively socialist policies at home, abroad, it would always support British imperialism. And that, Jeremy is something of an anomaly in the Labour tradition in that regard, because he is very anti-imperialist. And his position actually isn't particularly widely shared across the Labour left, who are more traditional, actually, in terms of their Labour Party politics. So Jeremy, and this is why he was isolated, and this is why he couldn't get a majority for his position, which is really to protect the right to speak against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, apartheid, and really, you know, if you look at history, I mean, his position is the moral, decent position, moderate position. And this is really, obviously, this has been a bit of an education for me, because it made me rethink the whole sort of Labour left term. Can you be a left winger and effectively support imperialism internationally? And my view is no, you can't. And I think Jeremy's genuinely a sort of a socialist. Quite a lot of the others, I mean, you're also, if you're supporting the imperial system, you're also supporting the military industrial complex. I don't think you can be a real socialist and support that.
The conclusion of that is that it's impossible to be a socialist and for the Labour Party to really affect any kind of change, isn't it, really? I think, I mean, when you say, I know you think that, I mean, and I suppose, you know, I don't know if you've listened, but, you know, my thesis at the moment is, because what I think we should do on the left is we need a party with brand identity, and I think we should, my plan at the moment is to reverse into the monster raving loony party and take them over with a socialist, you know, just, you know, you've got the brand recognition already. Just graft on a kind of socialist agenda. They may already have a socialist agenda, I don't know. But it sort of hints really at the impossibility of, I mean, because we talked about factions and the sort of huge, Labour Party's always been, central to the founding of NATO, and it sort of hints at the impossibility of really the Labour Party ever effectively bringing about anything that we'd like to see, really, I think.
Yeah, I mean, what was really brought it home with me, because I didn't used to be particularly left-wing, you know, I joined in 2013 thinking, yeah, Ed Miliband, you know, and it's what actually shifted my politics dramatically was both having Jeremy Corbyn on a platform talking sense, and one of the things he's really good at, actually, is putting things quite simply, putting otherwise quite complex and quite controversial ideas that are nevertheless common sense in a way that actually makes them sound like common sense rather than this kind of dogmatic political theory, which you often get from the left, is kind of Marxism and all that, which people don't understand and it's quite hard to engage with. But also the more significant thing, and I know you've mentioned this, Alexei, in one of your previous podcasts, is that I realized just how horrible the Labour right were at the time.
Yes.
And so I shifted leftwards, thinking, oh, maybe, you know.
They're just horrible, horrible people, aren't they?
Awful. They're just, I mean, I used to get on with them in my CLP, you know, when I first joined. And then with the whole Corbyn thing, I was a relative moderate. I was saying, hey, guys, let's all be friends. We're all, you know, we're all after the same ends, ultimately. And, yeah, no, that's not true. Really not. But the other thing with me and my CLP is I pushed so hard, you know, for Corbyn. Maybe this is a similar situation to Chris Williamson on a much less traumatic kind of scale. I pushed so hard for Jeremy Corbyn, I found myself isolated because the right and the left kind of joined forces against me.
Wow.
Really? That's my lesson for the Labour Party is well, don't join it. And you can't fight for socialism within it, because if you do...
I can see why the right would gang up on you, but why the left?
It's because the positions I was taking, I think... I mean, it was some specific local issues. Like I was fighting against the demolition of a council estate. Really, really important to me. One of the supposedly socialist councillors was in favour of it. And so there was a division there. But also on the anti-Semitism stuff, I wasn't in line with... a lot of the people on the left, who I thought when they first came in were more radical than me.
Yes.
But it turns out not. It's a really weird position to be in, to have been like this kind of relatively centrist person very quickly to find that you're the most radical out of all of them. And you're bringing in these kind of Marxist people into the Labour Party and trying to get them to work with the Labour right. It turns out that actually them and the right had quite a lot in common, and probably more in common than I did with any of them.
I mean, also, I think probably not now, because we might need a lawyer standing by, but I think it would be fascinating to do a kind of deep dive on Labour politicians and property developing. I mean, both on the left and the right. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, some of it is, you know, it's just a kind of weird kind of hatred of old stuff that I think just pervades element into the left. But obviously, if you're a councillor, then one of the real areas of power and scope for corruption that you have, the only really area for power, is in terms of property development. And maybe at some point we could get somebody on who could talk about that, because there's a lot of dirty shit goes on.
I mean the estate that regeneration that I was fighting against has just been signed off by the Mayor of London, and in my interpretation it goes against, I mean, it's Cambridge Road Estate in Kingston, if I don't know if you'd include that, but it goes against, in my view, it goes against all of, or a great swathe of mayoral guidance, and of it being that it's actually not going to make any money.
Well, that's the other thing. I don't know whether it's deliberate or just stupidity, but they managed to get absolutely fucked by big property developers, and it benefits, you know,
Trellick Towers. The council is under threat as well, isn't it? Trellick Towers?
Is it? No, I think it's just under threat of gentrification. That's all. They'd never knock that down because it's
historic.
It's obviously Arno Goldfinger.
Don't put it past them. I mean, Labour Council, this is another thing with Labour Party. Labour councils are actually among the worst on this, particularly in London, when it comes to demolishing council estates.
It's like, that fact alone is like, tells you all you need to know about the fucking Labour Party.
Yes, it does. And again, I mean,
Do expand.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was the issue I had. You know, the councillor, they were in opposition, so they weren't decision makers, and it wasn't a case of corruption. It was a case of, I don't really understand the logic, because to me it went against common sense what they were saying. But again, I mean, my position was the Corbynite position, and they were supposedly a Corbyn loyalist. I mean, I hope this isn't breaking a confidence, but I mean, Jeremy didn't actually support my campaign personally, but El Gato did. He appeared on one of our leaflets.
You know, El Gato and Wilf are very close.
That took a lot of pulling strings to be able to make that happen. So you know, ours was the kind of the proper Corbynite El Gato position, and my CLP, the left, were against that, and that's the dynamic. And this is on social housing. This is about demolishing social housing in order to build relatively expensive properties that are going to put the rent through the roof and prevent people from moving back. And one of the scandalous things actually on this, which is why we drafted in El Gato, is that there was no guarantee that people would be able to keep their pets when they came back. And
right,
and you know, that's, I mean, that's
fucking, that's,
it's evil, awful, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. We should point out that we assume everybody knows, but for those who don't know, El Gato is Jeremy Corbyn's feline guest. He's not his cat.
Tenant.
He's a feline animal who shares his chooses to share his property with Jeremy Corbyn. Or maybe you could get an alliance of I think Wilf and my cat Wilf and El Gato and Larry, because I think he's secretly a Corbyn supporter.
I think Larry is quite sensible, really, at heart. I think, you know,
he's certainly the most insensible person in Downing Street, even though shit in a litter tray. Anyway, sorry. Yes. That is another kind of condemnation of the Labour Party, isn't it? That whole intersection between them and their property and property deals and shit.
I think there's a lot of culturally as well. It's not just corruption. I think, I'm sure there is corruption, but I think also there is, the Labour Party has become quite middle class. Maybe it always was, I don't know, but it's become relatively, a lot of the people in it care about how they're perceived by other well-to-do people. Mm. And so there is an element of that, is if you take this position that's not seen as respectable by, say, other councillors, for instance, then you'll be ostracised from the club, the informal club, as it were, of people who are, basically, it's the establishment, local and national establishment. They still want to be part of that. Again, you see this, I think, with the kind of the Labour left MPs as well. I mean, if you look at the Ford report, when that came out, and the reaction of the Labour left MPs is, for the most part, silence.
Yes, not a dicky bear, really.
Also, the reaction to the removal of Jeremy's whip, I thought, was really, really shockingly weak.
Feeble, yeah.
And these are the people who are supposed to be the vanguard of socialism in Parliament, you know.
And what the motivation for that is, just a kind of inclination, not to, a desire to be just part of the establishment, you would say, but go with a kind of a
self-preservation.
And as a mixture, I think there's, and again, if you look at some aspects of Trotskyism, which I'm still in the process of researching, I'm hardly an expert on this, but other people who could tell you more about it, is that some Trotskyite groups, I think the AWL is probably included in this, for example, see the Labour Party as central to the class struggle. So, if you're not a member of the Labour Party, you're effectively politically dead. I think this from experience.
I have to obviously, because my my parents were in the CP and therefore very much opposed to Trotsky. So I was always, and then I was a Maoist. So I am brought up in, to use Trotskyist, to see a squirrel squashed in the road, and my mother would say, "Look at Trotsky."
I'm
prejudiced in that sense, but nevertheless,
I'm actually no fan of Trotsky myself. I think he
it's funny, isn't it? Because in a sense, Trotsky was. I mean, I don't know if the problem. I'm very illiterate about all this stuff. In a sense, I mean, Trotsky was right in that. I don't know whether we can summarize the split. I don't know how literate in this shit our listenership are, but basically the Trotskyan, Trotsky expected to inherit he was the military brains behind the kind of Bolshevik revolution, you know, and, you know, crushed the uprising of the sailors in Kronstadt in whenever, 1920, was it? You know, which was a sort of, to me, the death of the you know, the any pretense that the Bolshevik revolution had of being equal. But nevertheless, then, he, of course, he lost out in the leadership to Stalin. But his theory was that essentially that Trotsky said you couldn't. Stalin said you could build socialism in one country, whereas Trotsky, maybe because he had to flee Russia, said you had to build it all across the world, which was just kind of right in a sense. I mean, in some ways he was right. It's just Trotskyists who were like, after it was just awful.
I'm not literate in Trotskyism, but my dad was grew up as a Trotsky believer,
did he?
Follower, and he was in like a guerrilla activist Palestinian liberation group, which was Trotskyite, and they came to London. He was like in the London branch of it,
right?
And their biggest rival in anything political activism was another Palestinian liberation group, but they were Marxist, and they were like, they were fucking hated each other so much. Yeah. Were always like, you know, at student events, giving out flyers. They were like, "This is my territory. Fuck off!" You know, like, you know, proper.
I mean, it is literally the People's Popular Front of Judea, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah. And they were both called. Yeah. One was called PLFOP, and the other one was called FLPOP. Like, it was so similar. I was like, why didn't you just team up and double your strength?
Didn't
like,
they?
No, never. And he was
one of them. They had, when I lived with Wasim when I was a student in Finchley, the PFLOAG, the Popular Front for the Liberation of the Occupied Arab Gulf, they had their annual conference in our flat once.
Yeah.
I just woke up one morning and there was like 100 Arabs.
Were they Trotskyites? Was that the same group as my dad's?
I don't know. It sounds similar, but.
And it could be the other one.
No, because that was like one of my dad's best mates. It surrounded by
Arabs. PFLOAG.
No, Wasim. That's why we know each other through him.
Sorry, we've gone off on a tangent. But I have to say, I have mixed feelings about Trotskyism and Trotskyists. But carry on, Phil. Sorry.
I can't remember where I was with that. But
Trotsky. No, I don't either. Oh, they were Trotsky, saying that for Trotskyists, labor, they think that. Labour Party is central to the...
Yes, some do. Not all of them. And like you say, there's this kind of split between the Judea People's Front and the People's Front of Judea and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, people like Stop the War are not necessarily going to take the same line, or definitely not going to take the same line on imperialist stuff as the AWL, for instance. They're very different. But in some Trotskyist groups, and the AWL, I do believe, is quite influential on the Labour left, the remaining within the Labour Party is central, because they believe that that's where the class struggle is located. My view is that, in practical terms, I think that's actually nonsense, because, you know, well, partially because of organisations like the AWL, because they're imperialist, and so the Labour left is therefore, a large section of it is just as imperialist as the Labour right, and indeed the Conservative Party. And the other reason it's nonsense is because the Labour Party is so middle class in many respects these days, in terms of its membership and its representation on councils and things. I mean, there just is no class struggle in the Labour Party in any meaningful way. It's all middle class and pretty right wing.
Yeah.
You did mention in your Canary article the kind of contradiction. There's like, you talked about the 1945 to 51 Labour government that created the NHS and a lot of trade union, were pro trade union stuff, but then they were doing all that imperialist, they supported the imperialist stuff abroad.
Yeah.
And
my kind of take on that is the Labour Party is always, I could be, and maybe not in the very, very early days, but by and large, always been an imperialist party. And my take on that is, because of the way the British Empire and my view on this is actually slightly kind of left of field, is that I think the British Empire is still a thing, because if you look back at the history of the British Empire, it was always run through corporate finance. So the origins of the British Empire go back to the, sorry, this is a bit of a boring history lesson, but the origins of the empire go back to the time of Queen Elizabeth the First in the English East India Company, when that was established. And effectively, the City of London was built up around the administration of the East India Company's finance. So the British Empire actually started out as various different territories owned and occupied by private corporations by royal charter. Yeah. So it was a privatized empire, largely centering on the English East India Company. And what we have today is the two biggest financial centers in the world at the moment are Wall Street and the City of London. They're about equal, although I believe the City of London has a bigger role, a much bigger role, in administrating the flow of the US dollar, the petrodollar, outside of the United States. Mm. So the role of the British Empire, British finance, is still huge. And that is this kind of finance agenda. It's what drives privatization. And so in the 1945 to 1951 Labour government, because they didn't get rid of the empire, they didn't reorientate the core interests of the country. They still considered the country to be, you know, a country that's an empire is always going to prioritize the empire, even to the detriment of its own citizens. That's just the way these things work. So at the moment, we're looking at a situation where things are looking a bit shaky. We don't have access to quite the same markets we once did. And so rather than taking a hit to their profits, the capitalist oligarchs are asset stripping our own assets. Like the NHS is going. It's if not, it's already gone. And all of our public services are going. And that's because of international finance. And also because, you know, with less access to resources, the only thing that really guarantees access to resources is military spend, which is why we're seeing military spend go up, and also why we're seeing more and more aggressive wars, which Britain, obviously, and America are overrepresented in. Yeah. And so that's basically my view of the world. And I think the Labour Party has always stood for that by maintaining the empire. They've always prioritised the elite, because empires are only ever governed for and by the elite, and they only ever reward the very top of society. So even if you've got a Labour government that's nationalising things and introducing more welfare, they're doing it because they feel they need to in order to preserve the system rather than changing the system itself. Jeremy was a threat to that because of his internationalism. And if you read the 2019 manifesto, which I actually think is a very good document, apart from the Brexit policy, there is a sort of a foundation of a direction of travel in the foreign policy bit, which is actually, in my view, the best bit of the manifesto. Where it talks about moving away from NATO being this kind of alliance that's about sort of aggressive sort of military action, and more towards an alliance that tackles climate crises and provides rescue services for countries that need it, where they suffer natural disasters, which is, of course, that's increasing because of climate change. So Jeremy's got a very coherent, very sensible, actually, a very progressive position on this. And it's not really shared across the board. And so, yeah, that's basically my analysis of why we are where we are, is that the Labour Party isn't really capable of supporting a policy agenda that would move Britain out of its kind of imperial sort of straitjacket and into the modern world where we can actually do positive things with emerging economies.
Yeah, that's dispiriting but true. So to quote Lenin's one of Lenin's books, if we do found the Monsteraven Loony Party, brackets Marxist, MG Marxist, Gattoist, El Gattoist, what is to be done? Do you have any thoughts on that, Rennie?
Well, I mean, of course, if we were going to found that party, we'd have to split it very shortly after founding it.
Yes.
And I bagged the El Gato. I want him on my side because he's pretty tough. But in all seriousness, I think I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, and it's all still kind of up in the air. I don't have a specific answer. But firstly, you junk the Labour Party in terms of a vehicle for social change. You just don't even consider going there. My view is also you've got to move away from the Labour left pretty much comprehensively, because that is...
There's no working with those people.
We've tried to do it. I mean, this is the thing. This is let's be pragmatic about this. If the Trotskyist point of view, or the, you know, of some Trotskyist groups, is that you want to be in the Labour Party so you can change the capture the leadership and then change it from within. Well, that's been tried, and it's failed, not just because of the Labour right, but also because of the Labour left. So, done that, let's move on. The other problem is obviously the left is very split and likes to argue about relatively small issues, marginal
tiny
stuff.
Tiny, yeah.
So
they will always bring a composite motion to a knife fight, I think is the...
Sorry, I love that. Brilliant. To be fair, they're probably quite thick. You know, there's lots of
You can use it as a weapon. You know, Chinese martial art. Yeah, you can use a fan or a rice flail. You can use a composite motion.
Death of a thousand paper cuts.
Death by a thousand cuts. Paper cuts. So you've got to avoid that, and I think partially you've got to be aware of where there's actually kind of a position of natural sort of ideological commonality and agreement, and not try to work with people whose interests are completely opposed to yours. So with Jeremy, you're looking at basically people who are anti-imperialist and fight for Palestinian rights, and that's the starting point. And then you've also got to have a kind of non-aggression pact between parties and find a way of informally working so that you don't go for each other's votes because there's so small.
Yeah.
But
well, that is something. I mean, there was that. I mean, it hasn't worked so far, but that sort of alliance of those small socialist parties, hasn't that they did, you know, is maybe something to, you know, Northern Independence Party and so on. I don't know.
Well, I'm a huge fan of them because I was in PAL and got kicked out.
Well, interestingly enough, in our next podcast, the one coming after this, we will actually be looking at a way of an alternative way of being on the left, because I think that it's pointless trying to reform the political system while maintaining the same structures, that form, you know, kind of chairman, you know, fucking meetings, fucking agenda kind of bollocks, really. So in the next podcast, we'll be talking to somebody who has got extensive experience of a place called Rojava or Rojava, in where you come from, and you hadn't heard of it, had you, Talal, in northern Syria, which is run on the lines of, according to the teachings of Abdullah Öcalan, the Kurdish freedom fighter and philosopher, and is a feminist, is a largely feminist revolution, I think.
Wow.
We'll be looking at that next time.
I think we can also learn from the Latin American countries who actually do it quite well. I mean, this is the other thing. The Labour left always looks to the United States.
Yes, that's a really good point, because, I mean, the Atlanticism of the Labour Party is not something that's... Mm. I mean, fucking Gordon Brown, for example. I mean, he was always hurtling across to Stamford, wasn't he? That's a fundamental flaw in the Labour Party, isn't it, if you didn't have enough already.
Yes, I mean, because he got a lot of enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders, but, you know, let's not beat around the bushes that he failed, and he also kind of capitulated. So this is not necessarily the guy that you want to follow.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, people like
Hugo Chavez... I'm a bit more emollient than you, but yes.
they created a real social base rather than, a base among real people in real communities.
Are you talking about South America now?
Yes,
absolutely. I think that is one of the only ways to get around this kind of perennial problems of left organizations, is that idea of, talk about it further, really, in a sense. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the difference there is also with Momentum, which was primarily like an email list.
We haven't even got to Momentum, have we? No. I could talk for hours. I could literally go on for Momentum, yes. I think it's got to come via community organising, hasn't it, as well? It can't just be a political party, but it has to be a party that can. I'm not going to do anything about it, but I mean, if somebody else got it.
Then.
You going to do it?
Okay.
I'll give you my support. But I have other ideas about reforming the structures, but it can't just be a party which is about parliamentary politics, can it, really?
Yeah, well, Parliament doesn't really work in a very democratic way anyway. If you're talking about kind of amendments and things and how they get decided, it's which amendments get put forward is decided by a few people who go into a back room and thrash it out. I mean, there's no transparent process there.
It's
the entire political system is built around flimsy gentlemen's agreements.
Yes, I mean, do you think
that's the Queen?
I mean, do you think that is? Yeah, but I don't know whether I've got an opinion about whether the kind of the weediness of the Socialist Campaign Group MPs is because they're in Parliament, really, in that place. Kind of gets in your soul. And just as somebody who's been to Parliament, is what amazes me is how fucking tatty it is.
Yeah.
It's amazingly shabby.
It's actually really shit.
Yeah, it's awful. I don't like Gothic Revival that much anyway. I don't like Pugin and I don't like Barry particularly as an architect. So, you know, if it was Gilbert Scott or something, it would be a nicer building. But
so entrenched in history and tradition, it's just like I can't picture a world where we get rid of it. But it completely needs to go and something new built.
Significant reform. I mean, my personal view is an elected head of state as well, because the Queen can still veto legislation that affects us. So that's, I mean, in terms of Parliament, I say it's shit. Like for a large. Several months while I was there, the first floor of Portcullis House actually did stink of shit. It smelt like a sewer. And I just thought, wow, what an appropriate kind of metaphor for where we are. I mean, it's shabby. You know, the food's not that great. I just don't get it.
It's in a way, you know, it would be if we lived in a better country, the food would be better, wouldn't it? I mean, fucking drink is ample.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's the drink. You know, if you get to Parliament, you get
That Riverside Bar in Parliament. It's very nice. In fact, all the money went there. And you were talking, before we started recording, you were telling me a bit about your time in Jeremy's office and some of the messages you were seeing. I don't think we've... Have we brought that up yet?
No. Oh, the anti-Semitism stuff. While I was in Labour headquarters, well, I seconded over for a month and literally to get through the backlog of emails in the complaints inbox. I didn't make any decisions at all. But it was about collating the evidence and forwarding it on to people who did make the decisions. And so it did give me a kind of a really interesting sense of the kind of stuff that was coming in. And... I think a lot of it was by two people, if memory serves correctly. There's a lot of duplication of the complaints in terms of they're about the same people for the same things. And very often, probably more often than not, it wasn't specified whether or not they were actually Labour members. Mm. And so I found myself actually going through people's social media, actively looking for examples of anti-Semitism. Mm. And if you... bring in to that evidence, and because obviously you've got also this IHRA definition which links criticism of Israel to anti-Semitism. If you see criticism of Israel, you then have to then sort of see is there anything else in here that might imply that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. At least that was my understanding of it. Maybe I did it wrong, but there was. So even within the process that I was working to, there was kind of a bias, I feel. Inevitably there was, because it was working to that definition, which does have a bias against criticism of Israel. And the other thing that I've made this point elsewhere, and I think I want to say it again and I want to keep saying it, is that one of the people who was a decision maker, and supposedly on the left of the Labour Party, and this is why I've started thinking about ideology and stuff, one of the complaints team, relatively senior compared to what I was doing, openly stated in the office that they regarded Jewish Voice for Labour, who I have a lot of respect for and did then, as anti-Semitic. And I think they said something along the lines of it was one of the most anti-Semitic groups.
That's un-fucking believable. Well, I mean, of course, apart from anything else, they're Jewish.
Yes, of course. But that's we've now in a situation where the people who are being expelled from the Labour Party are disproportionately Jewish critics of Israel.
Yes.
And not only that, and at the time, actually, I did flag this internally quite gently, but it was quite clear that the focus on anti-Semitism, and obviously this was being driven by what was a witch hunt. If you're creating a campaign where you're trying to flood this inbox with complaints against often left-wing critics of Israel, that's a witch hunt. Mm. But it also meant that the focus was so skewed towards dealing with anti-Semitism or perceived anti-Semitism that my concern at the time was that it would lead to other forms of racism not being taken as seriously. And now that's come out in the Ford report.
Yes,
where the term hierarchy of racism. And one of the reasons I wrote that article was that I was just sort of, because I did mention it at the time, I was there for a month, so I didn't have like a comprehensive understanding of what was going on. I thought it was a risk. To see that sort of confirmed, really, it just took me aback, actually, because, this was avoidable. It's completely wrong. And I'm talking about the actions by the left, and, it's the left NEC. Again, Labour structures. Jeremy didn't have a direct role in the complaints process. Arguably, he was defeated over the issue of anti-Semitism in 2018 with the acceptance of the IHRA definition anyway. He couldn't even get a statement voted on supporting the right to criticise Palestine. He couldn't move that to a vote at Labour's NEC because he didn't have enough support for that. So that basically meant that even if he'd wanted to get involved in all this kind of stuff, he wouldn't have been able to do anything because he had no support on the NEC for it. But it was the Labour left. It was the Labour left NEC that was driving this racist complaints policy.
Yes.
And I think that's really shocking. It really is. And again, this is in my article. It's an absolutely damning indictment of both the Labour right, who were, this was their thing, they were pushing this, but also the Labour left for going along with it and accepting it.
Less often articulated. I remember you telling me when we were talking on the phone that when horrible woman Margaret Hodge called Jeremy a fucking racist, that he was genuinely upset about him and was going to do something about it until you said John McDonald actually intervened on her side.
Well, that's my understanding of it, because I obviously wasn't, was never in the room when these kind of high-level stuff was taking place. But I believe, I can't remember the exact day it was when it happened, but I went into it's been reported also, this incident, and this interpretation of the incident has been reported in various kind of anti-Corbyn books, and I think it's quite interesting that he comes out much better than John McDonnell does, in my opinion. And actually, like Owen Jones, for instance, they're always saying, John McDonnell was so much better. Actually, in my view, it sort of casts a better light on Jeremy. But yes, I mean, my understanding is that Jeremy was, he was knocked by the whole thing, I think. And so I do believe that that story that he was going to take action against Margaret Hodge and then John McDonnell went public saying, don't do it, is true, because I went in that morning and just the atmosphere in the office was just awful. And
he should have taken action against it.
Yeah, but if your shadow chancellor is saying that he doesn't have to back on that, you can't. If you're a leader of the political party and you're serious, and this is one of the reasons I have so much respect for Jeremy Still. Well, there's several reasons. One is he's just a lovely person. And he used to bring me cappuccinos in the office. Well, not me, but everybody.
Yeah.
And every now and again it'd be my turn. It's just, but he's very, very he spoke to everybody, but even sort of plebs, the lower orders like me, he talked to as an equal, which, I don't think Keir Starmer ever said a word to me, and he was in quite a lot.
Yeah.
So, yes, but Jeremy was always really serious about getting into power to bring the changes that he wanted to bring. This wasn't, for him, this wasn't kind of a sort of a flash in the pan thing. He actually wanted to do it. But when you are heading up an organization, the majority of which, you know, sort of 75% of which sort of hates your guts, and the other 25% is not really, you know, not really, doesn't really have your back, and is kind of looking after self-interest and their own kind of ideological positions. You're going to have to make compromises in on the day to day. And I think that's ultimately what happened. And you can argue the rights and wrongs of that. But at the end of the day, in the 2019 manifesto, he did secure a policy of banning, I think, arms sales to Israel and Saudi Arabia. And that's huge. I mean, that's what this whole anti-Semitism campaign was designed, in my view, this kind of the weaponization of these allegations was designed to stop. And we've also now got Amnesty International coming out and describing Israel as an apartheid state.
Yeah, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem,
And you, although the debate on this has been thoroughly lost within the Labour Party, in broader society, I really do think Jeremy's leadership of the Labour Party has led to a fundamental change of perception in this country. And I think we should be proud of that and grateful to him for that as well. There are other people who've played a role, like Chris Williamson, of course. But, you know, Jeremy's leadership of Labour was a key part of that, and it's very important. So it's had real positive impact. So, you know, he was trying to lead the Labour Party to victory, and in order to do that, had to stay in post. So he had to win the votes that he could win. The alternative is that he could have stood more firmly and then got kicked out, and I don't really what's
difficult that would have been my
I would have probably ended up like that, but
I was thinking my history as an employee before I became self-employed as a comedian, before then when I worked for people, my you know, my usual line was fuck you and your job.
Well, I mean, I think with Jeremy, what he's managed to do is, or he did manage to do, and always, because he's always about bringing people together. He wants to bring people together. So he'll make compromises, but up to a point where it doesn't sort of cross his personal kind of line, you know, when it comes to principles. And that was really put to the test as leader of the Labour Party. And I think actually he comes out of it pretty good in the circumstances.
I think our conclusion is, certainly me and you talk, you know, is that, you know, it was impossible. It was an impossible task.
It was, really. I don't think, had he won the election, if he'd been allowed to win the election.
I
think he would have been ousted very quickly. I think the Labour left would have allowed it as well. I don't think they would have, if you look at everything that's happened since, they wouldn't have stood and fought for him to carry on as Prime Minister.
No.
I mean, I think for me, all of the, and people will dispute this, and I'm sort of consciously taking a very kind of unsubtle and firm line on this, but I think the vast majority of the things that went well as part of the Corbyn era, and part of that is him managing to stay in for 5 years and fight two elections, which, given the establishment did not want him there, is itself pretty amazing. But the successes of it are largely down to him, his strength of character, and his ability to bring people together who really did not want to be brought together. And that's my kind of my piece on Jeremy, because, like I said earlier, I don't think he gets the respect or the recognition that he deserves. And it's a matter of personal respect, because I'm never going back to the Labour Party or any of that shit. But
It's a difficult, you know, but imagine if Jeremy, you know, you said that wonderful, if that man, that wonderful man, was the leader of a party that wasn't a stinking cesspit of infighting and betrayal, you know, what he could have done, really. But that is,
but also look at what he's doing at the moment, because the other positive aspect to his leadership is the profile that it has given him, not just in this country, but also across the world. And he's meeting a lot of world leaders in places like South America that we've talked about, and having very productive. You know, these are emerging economies. These are the
yes. And what I mean is, it will be soon that nearly all the major. I mean, assuming that Lula, there isn't a coup in Brazil, that Lula takes power in Brazil next year, that all the major economies, or a lot of the major economies, Chile, Argentina, will be Nicaragua, will be socialist, won't they?
Yeah. And Jeremy's pretty much the only person who is talking to them. And also, he's probably the only one that they want to talk to because, I mean, why would you want to talk to whoever the British Prime Minister is?
Or Keir Starmer, got that position at the moment, yeah.
He at the moment is kind of an ambassador for sensible Britain, in my view, when it comes to the emerging world powers in the world. That is incredibly important. We don't realize at the moment how important that is going to be, and we need to support him in that because at the end of the day, we're going to have to deal with these countries from a position of lesser strength than we have now. And Jeremy is helping in his own way to kind of smooth over what are understandably very bad relations because like China. I mean, Britain destroyed China, and they had the 100 years of
when we were forced them to take it. Yeah,
I mean, they must love us.
Never gets mentioned. Yeah, I think we're going to have to. I could literally talk for hours about this, but unfortunately, I think we need to end up.
Let's do a part two sometime.
All right, let's do a part two. Yeah,
I could go for that.
Yeah,
yeah.
We need obviously to test this first with our focus groups.
Mate, this is going to be great.
See what the viewing figures are.
It's been a while since we've had a...
See how it plays with a BCD socioeconomic group.
It's going to do fine.
Our advertisers.
A nice anti-Labour palate cleanser episode. It's been a while.
Yeah, do something.
It passes
a bit more.
All those tests. Anyway, Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it, and I love what you do.
Thank you.
It's just fantastic. Thank you, actually.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.